卵の殻を破らねば、ひな鳥は生まれずに死んでいく。我らがひなだ。卵は世界だ。世界の殻を破らねば、我らは生まれずに死んでいく。世界の殻を破壊せよ。
世界を革命するために。
Welcome back to the Shadowplay Gaze. We are a podcast where we talk about Revolutionary Girl Utena, the 1997 anime. I am your host, Derek Reining, and with me to help break the world's shell, it's Christine Palin.
Thank you. We have lots of operations to execute today, so I'm very excited.
Yeah, who are we going to prove is a weirdo today?
I was planning to prove you're a weirdo. I don't know what you're up to.
I mean, there's lots of weirdos on Utena For sure this week, every week, I'll imagine, but definitely this week, some weirdos going on. But I, you know what? Yes, I do carry a pencil case full of snails. Where else am I supposed to keep them?
And what of it?
Exactly. Are you going to beat me up about it? No, you're not. So I always forget that this is like so early in the series, and it's in what would ostensibly be a Miki episode, but it's like Nanami steps in her Nanami ways and makes it a Nanami episode.
Every episode Nanami's that. In is a Nanami episode. It becomes a Nanami episode.
Literally. And we love it.
Yeah.
We love that for her. But yeah, I guess to set the table, we are here to discuss episodes 4 and 5 of Utena. We're talking about the Sunlit Garden, both prelude and finale. Yeah, it's going to be lit. Sunlit.
Do you have any notes for our listeners about any content they need to be aware of?
I think the only really somewhat triggering thing I would say was, once again, Anthy gets hit by some girls, but it's not in the context of a relationship or anything. So I guess just a general violence warning in regards to that. But otherwise, I'd say this one's pretty low. I guess there's some like implied sexual content as well.
Some toga creepiness, but yeah, we won't. It's not a major part of the discussion.
And it's not shirtless super toga explicit. Warning.
Toga warning.
We always need that. What I found interesting, though, about this episode or these two episodes is that we start in media res, which has not happened yet. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting, especially because so much of Part one, at least, is all about how Miki refuses to do the duels. Like, he's like, I'm not going to do that. We're not doing that. But the episode, like, the show itself is telling us from the very jump, like, Miki's going to go back on that word for whatever reason. And I like that sort of mystery aspect of it, of, like, what's going to push Miki over the edge or convince him that he needs to be in this duel.
Yeah, it's we haven't seen the show, like, start, like, an episode like this, like, literally in the middle of the action. And, yeah, it kind of cuts down on the will he duel or will he not duel? Like, we know he's going to duel. It's just a matter of, like, what is going to drive him to duel, which is interesting. And we learn his name in the beginning, and we learn Juri's name in the early on in the episode. So we have, for our new listeners, blue hair, Miki, orange hair, Juri. And we see Juri in this opening with Toga's opera glasses. I don't know if they, like, share opera glasses that they pass around, or if they all, like, have their own pair as part of being on the student council. But, this we open with Juri watching. The dynamic between Juri and Miki in these two episodes is really interesting. I'm excited to get into it. But that is our jumping ahead. Then we jump back to the present, ostensibly. And I believe it's Miki playing piano.
Yes, that's where we start the episode. Although I do want to mention, the opening of the show also does mention a sunlit garden. Something to know, that jumped out to me this time. I never really noticed that before, but the sunlit garden is name dropped in the opening. But yeah, when we're back in the quote unquote present, we are treated to a lovely piano ballad from our boy Miki. I know this sub that's on YouTube that we sent the link out to spells it like M-I-C-K-E-Y. I'm used to, like, when I'm saying Miki, I'm like M-I-K-I. That's how I remember it being in the sub I originally watched. But we all know who we're talking about. Blue Hair Boy. And we also get kind of a flashback or like a reiteration of a scene we've gotten before with Anthy, where she's being assaulted by these three girls, these three Nanami minions, I think we can assume. But this time it's a little different because Anthy speaks up. She defends herself a little here, which I thought was really interesting. They're accusing her once again of, like, ruining a boy or like making a boy do something that they don't like. And she says, I never did that. She like actually speaks up for herself, which it's interesting. Maybe Utena's already having an effect on her.
Yeah, and like it's the way like Nanami is like framed in this episode, she's like really framed in like horror movie like filmmaking and like some of these shots, because the reason they slap her, it's not explicitly said, but it's, to me it's clear that like, because like Nanami sees Anthy's picture in Mickey's like music book and thinks that she's, Anthy's the girl he's playing the piano for, not her. It's implied that Nanami's like interested in Mickey, and so it's like, it seems that Nanami's like gone to her lackeys and been like, go fuck this girl up. Mm-hmm. And she's again watching from the shadows, as we saw in the last episode. Before we knew she was evil, we thought she was just watching and then helped Anthy. But this time she's watching from the shadows and is very clearly orchestrating this hit, a literal hit on Anthy.
Nanami Soprano.
Yeah. So then, what was I going to say? Mickey comes to her rescue, essentially. Because Utena and Wakaba are watching from, like, math class. We've just found out that, like, Wakaba's done poorly on a test. And apparently, usually, Utena is good at math, which is a character trait I would not have associated with her. But she doesn't say it's because of the duels, but it's implied that she's been really tired because of the duels and she's not doing well in school. And so they kind of see this happening from the window of math class, but it's Mickey who's the one who gets to come to Anthy's rescue, essentially.
Yeah, which is
interesting. With the stopwatch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's our like first little, I like that, like before he even intervenes, he hits the stopwatch, and then he comes in and is Anthy's prince in this moment. But yeah, it's interesting that Nanami, like it seems, the quote that comes to mind is, if you're familiar with Teen Girl Squad from Homestar Runner, like I believe it's cheerleader says, I have a crush on every boy. That's how it's starting to feel with Nanami's motivations, which we love that for her.
That reference is lost on me, sadly, but
oh,
I believe you.
No, okay. See, I'm so used to Sam being here and he would instantly get that, but that's okay. Yeah, so like we said, Mickey shows up and we get this cute little moment where I believe Anthy like smiles at him or like just looks at him, and these like this little quick flash of music notes goes across the screen, and I think that's just supposed to indicate like a sort of little the more anime inclined might call it like a doki doki moment, or like the heart, the pitter patter of the heart, like little moment there.
Which like fleeting thought of like, oh, like who, like is this something, like
yeah, some sort of interest. But I think that's a kind of the, I would consider that the sort of theme of these two episodes, is that Mickey seems to think, or people around Mickey also seem to think, that this is like a romantic interest with Anthy, but I don't think Mickey ever once states that.
Yeah.
It's always, he says things like, she plays like my sister, or she could be my shining thing, or it's like always referencing things that aren't about Anthy in any way, which I find intriguing and something to note. Like, I don't think at any point does he say, I like Anthy.
Definitely not. And he's like kind to her, and we'll get into this, you know, he helps her, and like, In the second episode, it becomes more clear, like kind of why he's doing the things he's doing. But yeah, it's other people who are making assumptions about, namely Juri and Utena. Utena's a real little shit in this episode. I love it. But before we get to that, because Wakaba and Utena are watching from the window, and Wakaba explains to Utena that Mickey is a genius who fences at the national level, and he's popular with the girls, and he's like their age, but he takes college like courses, and again, this is just another instance of where like we're seeing characters meet other characters through what other people say about them. Like the first time like Utena quote-unquote meets Anthy, it's Wakaba explaining who Anthy is, and here we have Utena meeting Mickey, but it's once again Wakaba explaining his reputation, which I think is something we see happen a lot on this show.
Yeah, it's almost like we're getting the I don't know, like the liner notes, or like, it's almost to bring in the sort of like theater play metaphor. It's like we're reading the sort of handout at the beginning to give us a little quick little snippet about these characters to us from some sort of omnipotent person. But it's usually someone who's like in this world, like interacting with them. So it's a biased opinion, but it's still like another sort of perspective giving us something. The people never get to introduce themselves or like explain themselves instantly. It's always, oh, I mean, to quote the Shadowplay girls, did you hear? Like, it's very that, which I like a lot. Mm-hmm. It's this, yeah. Show's great. I'll say it again.
This show's pretty good. We should do something. So speaking of us, we cut to the library where we see Mickey and Jury in the library, which is a visual representation of you and me doing literally this podcast. In case the viewers aren't clear, I'm Jury. Derek is Mickey. But so this is the first time we see Jury and Mickey interact outside of the student council meetings. And, you know, the student council, the vibe in the student council meetings hasn't been very, it's been a bad vibe, or like at least a tense vibe.
The vibes are rancid, yes.
And then Mickey is like grading someone else's paper, and Jury, like, we don't know what kind of relationship they have, but like they seem close. And like she seems like genuinely curious about him, and they seem to have some sort of respect for each other. We later learn in the second part of the episode that they both fence, that Jerry's the captain of the fencing team, or she's very good, because the girls watching are really surprised that Mickey beats Jerry. So we learn that they like have a shared hobby and like hang out outside of the student council meetings. And we saw Toga and Sayonji hang out outside the student council meetings in the depression kendo chamber, but it was more like, that was like all business and Toga being a dick. But here we actually see like Jury and Mickey seem to have some sort of relationship. And he mentions something about happiness maybe being closer than you think. And so it's implied that like something about meeting Auntie has like got the wheels turning in his head. But again, we don't necessarily know what it is.
Right, exactly. I believe we do start getting these little flashbacks here of him at the piano with someone. I think we get, I don't think we ever hear the sister's name, do we, in these episodes?
Not in these episodes, no.
No. Okay, so, but there's a sister that Mickey played with, and I love the sort of, as the this first flashback ends, we get these two butterflies that just flutter across the screen. I like that. The butterfly is the sort of symbol, I mean, obviously of change, but I also think butterflies, since they're like these two symmetrical halves, I think is just like a very, poignant sort of visual, like linking to this idea of twins or like twin souls here, the symmetrical butterfly wings. I just like that little moment there, because we don't really see them again at that point. It's just that little moment there. But yeah, so I feel like after this point though, we start getting into, well, we get the Shadowplay girls.
Well, yeah, because we get the flashback happens while Mickey's talking to Toga. So it's like Mickey talking to Jury, and then we get this little scene where Utena and Mickey and Auntie are all hanging out, and that's when Utena finds out Mickey's on the student council, and he's basically like, I don't care about the duels or winning Auntie. And then that's where Utena's like a little shit and been like, oh, you got a crush on her, and he's like, no, she just reminds me of someone I know. And then we see Mickey playing piano, Toga find the shining thing, and then we have this flashback, and then we cut to this hilarious horror movie transition of Nami listening in the doorway, because Toga's of course involved in this conversation with Mickey, so she has to be there, and it's like it's so funny, like I laughed out loud. It's visually just very good. And then we cut to the Shadow Girl, so we've ended on this image of Nanami in menacing, and we know like she's up to no good.
Absolutely, yeah. They bring up, like you said, this idea of the shining thing, which we can only assume is some sort of reference to like inspiration or some sort of like thing to like a sort of guiding light that Mickey may be looking for. And Nanami seems to, she like poo-poos the idea of like a shining thing. She calls it nonsense, which I think just speaks to maybe her childishness or something else about Nanami, where she just doesn't understand what these dum-dums are even talking about. What shiny thing? She's too busy planning out not one, not two, but three similarly operations. Named operations. Yes. But so before the
Shadow Girls.
Yes, yes.
So this one is pretty, I find pretty straightforward, and also, but also really interesting. And this whole sequence with Nanami and her operations gets written off as like, I mean, it's a very famous scene. It's one of those ones you see on YouTube with like lots of views and people are like, what is this show? Like, it's one of those out of context, very funny anime scenes. But I do think it's really interesting because in the shadow play scene, one girl says she has a boy who she loved, and he found out she loved pro wrestling and big bowls of garlic ramen, and he left her because he found out what kind of girl she is. And then they ask, do you know the truth behind the girl? And so I wanted to return to last episode with the dress prank, because on the surface, she's trying to humiliate Anthy by dissolving her dress, because once the dress dissolves, she'll be naked. And that's that, like, no one wants to be, like, naked in public. But, like, what does it mean to be naked? It means to be, like, exposed and to be seen as who you truly are with no way to hide. And in this episode, all of her pranks, which we'll get to in a moment, are her trying to, quote unquote, expose Anthy and make Mickey and Utena realize she isn't who they think she is. Like, in her mind, Mickey is saying, I'm so disillusioned. As the Shadow Girls put it, like, want to reveal the truth behind the girl. And it's just something to consider, like, why might Nanami think it's so bad for someone to see you for who you truly are? Like, I think it's really notable that, like, the worst thing, like, Nanami doesn't try to, like, physically hurt Anthy. It's to show some sort of hidden truth of her.
Yes. Or at least what Nanami thinks is the truth. She thinks that no one else can see what she sees in Anthy, which is apparently a weirdo. But I mean, she is kind of right. I think that's kind of also the point of the season scene. Like, she's doing these weird things to make Anthy look weird, but she assumes that looking weird would upset the other people. But it's like the problem for Nanami here is that Anthy outweirds her, and they still like her. They still find her charming despite all that. So yeah, like you said, Nanami is like just doesn't get it. She doesn't understand how someone could be seen or perceived as, like, strange or out of the norm and still be liked by people. That just seems very foreign to her. But, it's, like you said, this idea of exposing. She assumes that whatever she sees as the truth is the actual truth, and everyone else is fooled by some sort of lie. Which I love that kind of character. Like, those kind of characters are always the best, like, they're the most delusional, and they project that delusion onto other people, and that usually moves the plot forward in really interesting ways. And I think, hopefully, Nanami continues to provide that.
I wonder if Nanami's going to be entertaining.
It's a mystery.
And while we're on this note about Nanami, I did want to give a shout out to one of our listeners, Nagumo, who is the one who sent me this document called the Utena Dossier. And that is, like, this big, like, kind of, like, I think it's, like, a comic magazine thing, just all about kind of, like, the early production of Utena, of, like, the first arc or so. And Nagumo, like, I believe, did the translation for it, and it's going to be posted with, like, the scans with the English translation soon on the Empty Movement website. So once it's shared, we'll definitely share that. Awesome. But they're kind enough to share the Word doc with me, and they kind of pointed out, they're like, hey, for this episode, you should kind of, like, look at it. And I saw some notes at the end. But we kind of talked about last episode how Nanami seems like this very typical shoujo anime character. And there's a note, script note from Etikido in that dossier about how, like, they really intended to make her, like, the stereotypical shoujo villain in just, like, in the most over-the-top ways. And I don't know. There's, like, nothing stereotypical about her little pranks in this episode.
No.
But it's very bizarre, but it is playing on this idea of, like, she's a villain, but she's, like, a relatively harmless villain, it feels like.
Yeah, she's, like, a school bully, but one that doesn't, like, try to physically, I mean, she's able to hit you, but it's never about, like, endangering anyone's life. It's funny, though, that, yeah, the idea of the stereotypical shoujo villain, she literally has the Ojo-sama laugh here. I think this is our first oh-ho-ho that we get. Which is so iconic. We love that for Nanami. Let's run down the three operations we get.
So yeah, Nanami's up to no good, and she has a series of plots, and we learn through her, like, internal monologue, like, what her ideal outcomes of these plots are. And the first is she's gonna put a snail in Anthy's pencil box and prove she's weird. That's the famous Operation O, Anthy Himemiya is a weirdo who keeps a snail in her pencil box. And then her second plot is to put a garter, or some sort of snake in Anthy's drawer. And then the third plot is to put an octopus in her closet. And every time she's thwarted by Anthy, like, out-weirding her, so to speak.
Yes. It's perfect. And I just love that, like, I don't think anyone even moves in reaction to any of these things. Like, they just keep like doing their little notes. Like, this is just run of the mill for that. It's interesting because, like, Utena and Athi, like, we don't really know how long they've been living together. But clearly Utena is already very used to all of this. She's seen the snails in the pencil box. She's seen Mr. Mongoose. She's seen the giant inflatable octopus before. And Miki just finds it all charming. So literally backfiring into Nami's face. And I love that, like, as she, like, kind of reveals that she was trying to make them think she's weird, that Auntie is weird. And they're just like, they don't really react to that. They're like, sure, of course you were trying to do that.
Yeah, and I think it's like, and I feel like at one point in her internal monologue, she says like she's gonna beat Anthy, or like I think it's really interesting that she considers this like defeating Anthy would be to prove that she's weird, but of course it fails, and they just go back to math every time because the whole point of this is that they're doing math. And then yeah, we get Anthy with her cute little like elephant flip book, and like that's the thing that like actually gets some of sort of a reaction from Utena and Mickey, but it's like not that they think she's weird, it's just that she's not doing math.
Yeah, she's just not pulling her weight. But then we get this sort of scene where Auntie, like, after Nanami sort of gets upset and starts yelling at them,
Ghost
Auntie gets
Joker
a little.
mode.
She gets jokerfied by Choo Choo. Just like all of us, really, I think, get. But for us, it's a good jokerification. For her, it's not so good. But Choo Choo sends her over the edge. But then Auntie leaves, and Utena notices first. But they all suddenly hear this piano music, and it's the same song that Miki and his sister wrote, The Sunlit Garden. But when they go see Auntie, it's moonlit rather than sunlit. But Miki still, there's like, we see that sort of scene of Auntie sitting there with the moonlight streaming down on her. And then Miki sort of like transposes his sunlit garden onto that scene, which is like a big running theme in these two episodes, which is this idea of someone taking a sort of reality and placing it onto someone else. That's kind of like Miki's problem here in these two episodes, is that he's really projecting a lot onto Auntie here.
Yeah, these episodes, again, these are first episodes where we're really getting to like the character studies of the show, and like projection is one of like is incredibly important idea in the show. It's why, to me, one of the more fascinating, there's so many fascinating themes in the show. But this is definitely a pet favorite of mine. He like literally inserts Anthy into the memory of his sister, like literally casts her in the role of his sister in his memory. And he says he says like her tone of the piano is the same as his little sister's. Like it's the same. Like it's just she's just playing piano. He's just like reading into what he wants to read into. And he says he's found his shining thing. And that's what the first part of the episode ends, is him fully like, you know, we've gotten these hints of like the piano, the flashes of sheet music and the piano notes, but this is where we're fully getting Mickey like settling on like Auntie is my shining thing.
Yes, which, and that's also something worth noting, is it's not that Auntie, he likes her. She's a thing. She's some sort of guidepost for him. Which I think is also an interesting aspect about this next episode, the finale, as it's called. Which is this idea that, like, Miki, I think, seems really nice, right? Like, I think everyone can agree Miki seems like a good boy. But that doesn't stop the fact that he is essentially doing the same thing Saionji was doing. Saionji wanted to own Auntie for his own needs. And that's what Miki does here. But he, like, keeps contradicting himself throughout, especially the second episode, because he parrots Utena. Utena at some point sort of decries the entire duel process, because she thinks Auntie, she calls it a system that robs someone of their freedom, and the someone being Auntie here. And then Miki says that word for word later to Toga and Juri. And so he says that he values Auntie's freedom. However, the thing he's fighting for is to essentially force Auntie to be the shiny thing for him, to play piano for him. But he's convinced himself that Auntie wants that. That he, of course, she wants to be play piano all the time. Why wouldn't she? Which I so I think that's interesting that Miki is like becomes the villain here, even though, like, he seems very nice. It just speaks to how I guess this system, this dual system, kind of turns everyone into the someone seeking to possess, regardless of their intentions.
Yeah, and that, so like Juri's part in this episode, second episode in particular, is interesting to me because it feels like she's kind of trying to push Mickey away from dueling for Auntie. I can't quite figure out exactly, like, she's just very mysterious in this episode, because at the start of the second part, we see Mickey and Juri are fencing, and this is where we learn that Juri's the captain of the fencing team, and there are girls watching them, as there are always students watching, like, almost anything that happens on the show, and marveling at how cool they are, and Mickey, like, quote-unquote, finally defeats Juri, so we're meant to see that they kind of have this, like, friendly rivalry. And the girls run away, and it's just Mickey and Juri, and she speaks very cryptically, which I love. She's very mysterious, and she says his lack of perfection is his strength, and she wonders if the reason he's stronger is because of the girl whose paper he corrected, being Auntie. And she tells him his sword is not for battle. And it, to me, that reads to, like, Juri is, like, kind of, like, she's perceptive enough to see that, like, Mickey isn't the type to really want to duel for Auntie, but she can kind of sense he might be on that path. I don't know what your read on this is, but that after a couple watches, that was my read on what Juri's trying to do here, because that might be why she's watching, because she, like, didn't want it to happen, but just kind of curious as how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, and that's always, I think, my read on the situation too, which, I mean, we can, I guess, later read into why she feels that way, but here it just seems like she can sense that Mickey is a gentle soul. And he shouldn't be in this position where he's telling Auntie what to do, forcing her to be this sort of shiny object for him. Juri could see that. Because, I mean, Mickey this whole time was saying how much he didn't want to duel, how he thought it wasn't a good idea, how he didn't want to do it. And so I think Juri can see that too, and she sees that change in him. She can see the sort of desire to possess, like, coming into him, and she wants to protect him from that for whatever reason, presumably friendship. Because they seem pretty close. Definitely a very different dynamic, like we said, from Toga and Saionji, who seem like just two toxic assholes. Like,
whatever they have going on, it's not good.
No. Whereas these two, this seems a little more wholesome. It's almost like a big sister, little brother situation here, where Juri's not, like, outright saying, don't do it, don't duel. She's just, like, giving him the tools to figure it out for himself, in a sense, which I think maybe is the better lesson for him, mm-hmm. Is to use very cryptic words and just let him fight and lose.
And while we're on this scene of them fencing, I did want to kind of just, I think we can kind of save this conversation because fencing will come up again, because we have two characters now who fence. Spoiler alert, they're going to fence more in the future. But I wanted to kind of talk about the idea of fencing. So it's a sport that uses swords, and all around is similar to what happens in the duels. You know, there's, like, rules. And, you know, the duels themselves have, like, rules, you know, whoever's, you know, rose falls, you know, they lose. And like the duels, like, no one dies or gets hurt. Like, in the duels, like, you're not trying to kill someone. You're just trying to knock off their rose. So they're codified with, like, similar, like, rules, rituals, outfits. But what is the difference between fencing and dueling? I don't want to linger on this too long because there's a lot to talk about with this back half of this episode. But I just kind of wanted to bring it up as something for people to think about, because it is interesting that fencing out of all sports is focused on with these two characters.
For sure, yeah. And I think it's also, I mean, something else to think about is, in fencing, your face is completely covered. And you are indistinguishable from each other, whereas in these duels so far, everyone's, like we said, everyone's color-coded. You get your own specially colored rose and everything. Yeah, something interesting to note there. But like you said, there will be plenty of time to talk about fencing. But we also do start to get some more symbolism here. I talked about the butterflies before, and in this flashback in the second episode, the flashback to the moment when Mickey and his sister are being told that they're going to go play this concert, and then Mickey gets sick. We see these caged birds associated both with Mickey and the sister. It's interesting, both of these are involved, like, flight, these creatures that fly around, almost like music in the air. But I don't think something clearly has them feeling trapped in some way. Definitely the sister more so, as we learn at the end of the episode. But it's just like we'll get more opportunities, I think, to talk about these caged birds. But that's just something to note, like you said. And I also do like we also get the scene here where Miki kind of is talking to I believe it's Utena and Antti are in the room while mm-hmm. Antti plays the piano. And Miki's talking up how much Antti sounds just like his sister, how Antti's so good, and Utena just says something like, you're hearing something I'm not.
Exactly. It's very clear that this is something Miki is reading into, or that's something that, like, only means there's no, like, objective truth to what he's looking for. It is something that matters to him specifically. Like, Utena can't possibly pick out what he's describing because it's not really a real thing. It's an idea of a thing that's important to him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of, like, these important ideas, like we said, I brought this up before, but Utena brings up this idea of freedom here. And so that's something she wants for Antti, even though she is a part of this now. She's part of the dueling system. And maybe it's easy for her to say this now that she is engaged to the Rose Bride, but she's just like, yeah, this system sucks. And then we hear Miki say the very same thing in the next scene when he's like trying to convince them to disband the student council.
Yeah, he's like literally saying her line, like playing the role of Utena. It's very transparent. He's like, oh, that's a good idea. I should say that.
Exactly. But it's funny that their motivations are different here because, I mean, for Miki, he's saying that because he thinks that for Antti, freedom means playing piano with him. This is part of this idea of projection here, where he just assumes that because Antti can play the piano and knows the song he wrote, that that's what she wants to do, and that's what she needs. And so this is where the first sort of seed of Miki wanting to break Antti out of the system starts, but in his mind, to do that, you have to win the duel.
What do we think about the apple in the student council scene?
I believe it has its own little chair, right?
Yeah, there's an apple on a chair and it's whole. And then by the end of the scene, we cut back to it and it's been like cut into like neat slices.
Yeah, it's like in the little rabbits that you usually see in like bento boxes or for like lunches or something. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You clearly have some thoughts.
I don't quite know. It's worth noting, we won't get into the specifics of it, but that the apple and like caged birds also appears in Mawaru Penguin Drum. Are symbols that appear in more than one of Ikahara's shows. I think they can mean different things in different contexts because that's the great thing about symbolism. Like you can, you know, pull a lot of meaning out of it. All I can think of, the thing that kind of jumped to my mind, was we talk about the garden, the sunlit garden, and like the idea of like, I think like this representing something like paradise for Miki, and go a step further, think about the Garden of Eden, just think about the apple in the Garden of Eden. I don't know what necessarily it being whole and then it not being whole represents, but that was just the immediate thought when I saw that, thinking about all this talk of gardens and returning to certain gardens.
Yeah, for sure. I do think there's some like Garden of Eden symbolism going on there. I think to me, how I would interpret going from whole into these cute little like slices that you would probably like, this is something that like a mother would do for her kid and put it in their lunchbox for them. To me, it's like this idea of almost a childish interpretation of the Garden of Eden for Miki here. To him, paradise is just being with someone, anyone really. It doesn't even have to be Antti in particular, but someone who is like his sister, who can play the piano like his sister did in his memory. I think that to me is what that those slices represent, is a sort of someone trying to, I mean, it's just this childhood connection, I think is what they're mm-hmm. going for. At least that's what how I would read into it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't really have any like concrete, like there are certain like symbols and moments in the show where I have like very strong like personal interpretations of, but this is one that I think I don't have as much of a grasp on, but I do think that holds true to me. But speaking of the elusive sister, we actually meet her in the next scene. And I find this scene really, really interesting because Miki runs into a girl who is his twin sister leaving the music room. And I think it's really worth noting, like, he's not happy to see her. Like, they don't have a good relationship. And it's kind of been alluded that, you know, the relationship is never the same. He says he has no hope, and he has no more hope that she's going to play piano. And this is, to me, where it should be really clear that, like, because, like, there could be, you could read into Mickey's whole thing with, like, projecting his sister onto Auntie. It's like, oh, does he want to, like, date his sister or something? No. To me, it's really clear in the scene he's not in love with or even obsessed with his sister, but just the image of her in his mind, which is really just this, it's not so much her, it's this idealized image of his childhood. And so when he, like, meets her in real life, he isn't happy to see her because it doesn't live up to that image of their shared childhood anymore. She's different. She's unhappy. She doesn't play piano anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. It's interesting that we see, like, the sister shows up and it's kind of, it instantly clarifies. And I think the end of the episode is, like, a great, fantastic note to end on, because it really, really shows that this thing that's happening between Miki and Auntie, maybe this isn't the first time this has happened for Miki. Maybe Auntie isn't the first girl that this has happened with, or the first person this has happened with, because, like she says, she was never very good at piano. She never really enjoyed it. She just did it because her brother liked to do it, and it was for a boy. So there was never this girl, like we said, this version of the little sister that exists in Miki's mind never really existed. This is kind of a pattern for him, we can assume. The swirling snail, the ammonite, death and rebirth, as the song in this episode talks about.
I have, like, an annotated, like, I have so much to say about this song, so I'm excited to get to it. But before we get to that, we have to get to Creepy Toga.
Oh, God.
Because she's, like, comes out of the music room quite disheveled, and he says, like, she says, like, oh, you can do other things in the music room other than playing music. I don't remember what she says.
The music room isn't just for playing the piano.
Thank you. And it's very much implied she's had some sort of sexual encounter with Toga, who has his jacket wide open. And, you know, is this the first time we see Toga's bare chest?
Yes, I think so. And this is confirmation Toga fucks, and I don't like it.
Unfortunately, Toga fucks.
Yes.
Unfortunately for us all. And Toga says to Miki, when Miki walks in, he says, "Your sister is just as cute and easygoing as you are." They're twins, and so that's, you know, not necessarily a strange thing to, like, draw attention to, that twins are similar. But I think, you know, we have Mickey's sister and Auntie as being kind of, like, parallels to each other in his mind. But then you also have someone drawing a parallel between Miki and his sister. And I think, again, this just kind of gets to the idea, it's more about Miki than it is about his sister.
Absolutely.
It's not, she's just there. And she was just there, and she represents something, but she's more of a reflection of his own desires.
Absolutely. I love that this sort of, it also, I mean, plays into the Shadowplay girls from last episode, when they're talking about what's the truth under the girl. That applies to, not, like, when you first watch that, and in the context of the episode, it seems to be referring to Auntie or maybe even Nanami, but here it's like, we're talking about the sister too. Like, what is the truth behind the girl? The truth is that that girl that he thinks of like never existed.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. This is a great two-parter in that sense. But we get more Shadowplay girls here, and they're pirates this time.
Yeah, but we have a few more things to get to before we get to them, because Toga gives this big speech about having to defend the things you possess, or someone will take them away, and that only the one engaged to the Rose Bride can make her do what they want. And I think this is the first time Toga gets the red border instead of white.
Yeah.
Because he had previously been getting the white borders when Utena thought he could be her prince. But now he is getting red in this scene. And maybe it happened before, earlier in this episode. I'm not sure, but this is where I noticed it. And so, yeah, Toga's trying to kind of, like, coerce Miki into dueling by being like, if you don't, like, he's drawing this, like, it's unclear how much Toga knows, because he seems to, like, get that what Miki's really about is his sister and not Auntie. That's why Toga does something gross with his sister. I say gross because Toga's gross.
Absolutely.
So Toga seems to have some sort of knowledge about what's going on in Miki's head here, and that's why he makes a move on his sister to kind of be like, look, if, you know, you don't fight for this image of your sister, someone else will take it.
Exactly. Yeah, he shows how easy it is, apparently, to do that. And yeah, the red roses are an interesting note. Is that because it's Miki who's perceiving him here? Is it because it's like a very sort of sexual nature and red is like a symbol of passion, whereas the prince is more pure white? Definitely something to think about there, because like we said before, colors are important here. It's upsetting in the sense that Toga is involved and Toga has his shirt off, but it's interesting that we keep seeing Toga as the manipulator.
Yeah, and like Miki has this vision of sexy Toga in a bedroom seducing his sister. It didn't happen in a bedroom, happened in a music room, but Miki like recasts it to be even more like sexual or like this like overtly romantic thing than it probably was. It was probably not, you know, I don't want to imagine what happened in the music room, but like the way Miki imagines it is quite elaborate with like the flowing bed and like the windows open. It's just very interesting, the image he has of Toga. That kind of ultimately drives him to agree to duel Utena. But what really makes him want to duel Utena is when he has this conversation with Antti, being like, oh, you know, you if like Utena told you to stop playing piano, what would you do? And Antti's like, I would stop. Mm-hmm. And Miki then convinces himself that the right thing to do is to duel for Antti, possess her, and allow her to play piano, because that's what he's convinced himself that she wants.
Exactly, yeah. And this is like I said before, it's like he's suddenly becoming the Sionji who wants to possess, but he's doing it for quote-unquote good reasons, or at least what he thinks are good reasons. He walks into the classroom. I don't think we've seen that presented this way before. He like hands Utena a rose to do. Yeah. I don't think Sionji ever did that.
No, because the first time it was like Utena just stumbled into it, and the second time, yeah, he definitely did not hand her a rose. I cannot picture him doing that.
No, and it's a white rose.
Yeah.
But that's Miki's way of challenging Utena to a duel. And of course she's Utena, so she just instantly agrees. And so I believe this is when we get the pirates, right?
Yes, we get our girls.
Yes. And I really liked this one a lot too. Just because it's like I feel like the first one obviously is like sets the tone for the whole two-parter, whereas this one like kind of hones in on this idea of possession or seeking something, finding that shining thing here. And this was pre One Piece. The One Piece in this situation though is Antti here. This thing that he's seeking. I feel like this was kind of a shorter one, but it's still like really just like does a good job of hammering home this idea of possession or seeking something out. I don't know why pirates specifically, but I mean, why not? Pirates are cool.
I mean, yeah, pirates you could get at. Like the idea is that pirates take things that don't like actually belong, like rightfully, quote unquote, rightfully belong to them. And like, so you could think of like he's trying to like force something onto Antti that isn't true and like claim her.
Sure.
When he has no inherent right to do that. It's just this like weird setup of the duels and his own projections that's like, yeah. Also, pirates are just cool.
They are, yeah. And I think it's, you could read in like, I mean, pirates are swashbuckling, like they see themselves as the hero in their story. And I mean, also if you just want to get down to like basic stuff, like Miki's hair is blue like the ocean, sure, why not? And I mean, we do get a lot, like we've in these songs we do get a lot of ocean imagery, this idea of like the primordial sea, but this one specifically is a lot about death and rebirth, to the point that that's like the final refrain.
Yeah. And a shipwreck song. It mentions the shipwreck in the lyrics. Yes. And in this, at the end of this Shadow Girls play, the ship sinks. And so I take the ship sinking, because the ship sinks because the Shadow Girl pirate, like, can't verbalize what she actually wants. Like, when she's pressed on, like, what do you actually want? Like, she can't verbalize it, and so the ship sinks. And to me, that represents, like, Miki doesn't actually, like, the shining thing isn't actually a specific thing. And if he were to, like, recognize that what he's looking for doesn't exist, his ship would sink. Like, it would, it would, like, he would have to, like, completely reevaluate the way he's living his life and the way he's moving about the world.
That's absolutely my interpretation. No, that makes total sense to me. Like, yeah, if he took 1 second here to really examine why he's doing what he's doing, there would spring a leak, and suddenly he'd be up Schitt's Creek without a Shadow Play Girl boat. Yeah, and so then we get to the duel.
Yes, and jury's watching.
Yes, jury again. And we finally get to the in media res that we started out this two-parter with. I think jury's opera glasses are a little more ornate. I think she has her own.
Okay, I love that for her.
Yes. to me, like, the thing about this duel, like, it's not, like, super flashy duel or whatever, but the one thing that I think really stands out to me in this duel, besides, like, the song, is that we get the moment that Miki loses is when Antti cheers openly for Utena. And he just, like, instantly, I think that we talked about before in Nanami's dream, he says, "I'm disillusioned." I think this is his moment of disillusionment.
Absolutely.
When Antti is not, I mean, presumably just is not rooting for him and is fine with being with Utena. She doesn't feel trapped, apparently, and so I think that just, like, instantly sort of shatters that thought he had of Antti. He assumed probably that she was rooting for him, that she wanted him to free her, that he was her prince. But it doesn't seem to be the case, and that's where he loses.
Yeah, like, his whole reason for dueling Utena was predicated on the idea that Antti, like, wanted to be saved by him for her piano playing. And so, like, once she cheers on Utena, that the illusion is shattered. Like, physically, we see the picture of the garden in his mind break into pieces, like it's a piece of glass. Like, he's, like, literally has this illusion physically shattered in his mind. And that, you know, knocks him off his game. Like, what's worth noting, like, Miki is, again, we've seen he's a good swordsman. Like, he's good at dueling. Like, he's, like, Utena's good, but we see her, like, she's, like, out of breath during this duel.
Yeah.
And so it's, like, he could have beaten her. But, like, and she doesn't, like, you know, we saw in the last duel we saw, she only really seems to have beaten Sionji the second time because of, like, the prince coming down from the sky. But we don't see the prince or whatever. Like, nothing exterior seems to happen here other than Antti just cheering on Utena, and that's enough to make Miki lose. There's no, like, outside force controlling whatever is happening in the duel.
No, for sure. And yeah, like you said, she seems, like, pretty out of breath. She's, like, on the ropes the whole time. Like, he compliments her, but it's, like, clearly coming from a place of, yeah, but I can still beat her. But it just takes that moment, and I think that's kind of what Juri was talking about. His sword was not meant for battle in that sense, and that he can't, like, he loses it at the instant that he loses this idea of Antti. And so the duel ends on this death and rebirth repeated over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of want to say a few things about this duel song.
Yeah, go for it.
So there's, the song is, of course, again, evoking the idea of theater. I think, like, the first line of it is the theater, extraordinary spirits, a collective phenomenon. And then I just highlighted some different things. The words fanciful reality, and which I think is very much related to the idea that, like, Miki is, like, acting out this, like, false, based on this, like, false idea of his past. And then we get the words spira mirabilis, which is Latin for miraculous spiral. It's just a logarithmic spiral. And so it's, like, on a graph. And it's worth noting that they were doing math last episode. Yes. I don't think that's a coincidence. This also evokes, I did some Googling because I didn't know what Scipio's dream was. Do you know what Scipio's dream is?
I do not. What is it?
So the dream of Scipio was written by Cicero, and it's the sixth book of his De Republica. And it is a book that describes a fictional dream vision of the Roman general Scipio. Scipio Animalius, set 2 years before he oversaw the destruction of Carthage. That part's not important, but it's this idea that it is a fictional dream vision, like a fictional dream account of this person, Scipio.
Interesting.
Which is, yeah, very, yeah, like, Miki is acting on this, like, fictional dream vision of his childhood and of his sister. And then the other, we have Ammonite return again, which we talked about the spirals, and then the sacred scarab. And the Egyptians, ancient Egyptians, saw the Egyptian scarab as a symbol of renewal and rebirth, and it's affiliated with the god Khepri, who represents the rising or morning sun, and so it can represent the creation and renewal of life, which of course goes to the death and rebirth of the end of the song. And there's, you know, the geometric stage, again, referring to math and theater, and then extuant all, which is used as a stage direction in a printed play to indicate that a group of characters is about to leave the stage. That comes up near the end of the duel, so that's like a hint that this duel is about to end and these characters about to leave the dueling stage. So yeah, those are all my notes.
Damn, yeah, I mean, those all make sense to me. I think obviously spirals are a big thing because, as we know, Jigsaw is
Jigsaw.
Very important. But yeah,
Chuchu is the Jigsaw of this universe, I feel like. Absolutely. I feel like Chuchu's up to something.
That is for sure. But yeah, like obviously spirals, this idea of cycles. But I think like the specific, like we said, the dream imagery for sure is very important. And the idea of a sun god, the sunlit garden, are all very interesting to me. But I think also just this, you have to think about the idea of music. Like, music is very important to Miki here. We see a lot of music notes throughout this. And obviously a big part of music is math. So I like that they're making this sort of connection between math and music for Miki's character here. The sort of like geometry of art in a way. So yeah, I guess something to note there. Miki is into math rock.
Yeah, Miki, period. That's the moral of the story.
Yes.
Before we move on from the song, I did learn in the Utena dossier provided by our listener Nagamo. I did not know this. I don't know if you knew this, but the duel songs are sung by a children's choir.
Oh, I did not know that.
When you hear male voices, one of the voices is Ikahara, and then the other, like another male voice is a composer, Shinshiki Mitsumune, who is in charge of like arranging the music. But yeah, all these duels are being sung by children. I just think it's interesting to think about, like, why a children's choir.
Interesting.
Very interesting. I do think it's something to just keep in mind because I did not know that. I just assumed it was like women. But I looked it up and yeah, they worked with, I think, various children's choir, at least more than one. I saw a couple more children's choirs credited. So interesting.
Very interesting. Okay. I mean, do we know how old they were?
No, I can do a little more research. I just learned this this afternoon. So
right, sure. But I'm just like wondering if they are maybe they're middle schoolers, like most of our guests. But okay, good to know. Children.
Yeah, thank you, Utena Dossier, for
seriously.
Endless stream of knowledge.
Awesome, awesome resource and awesome person. Thank you so much for translating. Like you said, we will definitely link that when that translation is finished, because it sounds like they put a lot of effort into it and it should be put it out there for everyone to enjoy.
Yeah, it'll be on the MP Movement website, which is an amazing website, and everyone involved with it's super cool. And so I know some of them listen to this, so thank you for listening.
Yeah, seriously, thank you so much. I guess any other thoughts on these episodes before maybe we close out for the week?
I mean, yeah, so we see at the end of this episode the reveal that his sister never really liked piano that much, and she was never good at it. And I think it's really notable that the inciting event that made her stop doing it was when she was put on stage at a concert by herself. I think the fact that this happened in public on a stage is important. And yeah, it ends up being like it's all around like a sad story. Like
it is.
The fact that like Miki like he seems to like resent his sister for not wanting to play piano, but also blame himself. It's like they aren't connecting. Like they could have bonded through this, and like this could have been something that brought them closer together, but it seems to have driven them apart.
Yeah, I believe the phrase he uses is that he destroyed it by his own hands or something along those lines there. So clearly a lot of blame and guilt going into it, but like you said, some of that is being directed at his sister there. But I think this is the perfect note to end on for the episode. Like fully pulling the curtain back on Miki's illusion. Like we could have gone this whole episode, this whole two-parter, and just assumed that Miki was telling the truth the whole time, that his sister was a really talented pianist and that she did play beautiful music. But no, like we hear it from herself, and she tells the story almost dispassionately. Like it's been so long that it doesn't really mean much to her anymore. And it's just to some random classmate that we don't even know. She's just like casually, I never really cared about this. I did it for a boy once, and then this horrible traumatic thing happened to me, and now my brother and I just aren't close. So I hopefully not the last we see of her or this storyline. because there's a lot to go off of here.
Yeah, the first time I watched this show, the first time I watched these episodes, I really wasn't that interested. I really didn't care about Mickey that much. But as like on subsequent watches now, I find these two episodes really, really, really interesting, particularly the second one, the way it's set up, that great reveal at the end that, you know, she was never good at piano. I just love that kind of reveal. And yeah, I really like these episodes. And again, as I believe this is really where the show truly, the first few episodes are very important, but these two episodes are really where we start to see the kind of important character work that's going to start happening on this show, where you can just watch these episodes a million times and pick apart different character motivations and what might be going on. Because what I love about the show is we're given so much to work with on these characters, but very little is said explicitly. We're left to, like, you know, we get that explicit moment at the end with his sister, you know, with the gagging the girls with this reveal. But, you know, we don't get Mickey. It's like, you know, he doesn't know why he's doing these things. And so I like that. That's because that's how real people are. We don't know why we do things. And he's not aware of what he's doing. And that makes it even more interesting, because you can pick out, like, okay, why? What's the psychology behind this? What's the character motivations? And that's why it's such a great show to have a podcast about, because it's really fascinating character work.
Absolutely, yeah. And Mickey, I do think, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, Mickey is, like, not high up on anyone's list, really, probably. Mm-hmm. But like you said, these episodes are really fantastic, and they give us a good taste of, like, how the show is going to be moving forward. And they do a good job of not really wrapping it up for Mickey. I don't think Mickey really learns his lesson by the end of it. He just, like, learns that Auntie does not want to be free, but he's not really learned all this other stuff we talked about that he needs to learn. So there's a lot more work for these characters to do on themselves by the end of it. It's not all wrapped up in a neat little bow. We didn't really learn a lesson here beyond just the fact that he was projecting on Auntie specifically, but he still has a really messed up relationship with his sister. So like you said, this is a great sort of kind of, we're starting to get really into the weeds here of the show, and we're only on episode 5.
Yeah, and I think it's just very funny that this episode ends on the sentiment of Mickey going up to Utena being like, okay, I won't lose again. And Utena just being like, the episode ends on Utena saying, oh boy. Which is just so classic, because Mickey hasn't learned anything. It doesn't seem like Utena's learned anything either. Like, it doesn't seem like she's, like, perceived much about
Mickey. Yeah, we have no idea what her read on the whole situation was.
She no just thoughts, was, head oh, empty.
No, yes, which we love. We love our girl forever and always. But like we said, though, I feel like from the beginning of the episode, Auntie standing up for herself, something's going on with Auntie, at least someone's changing. So I guess, are those our thoughts on the Sunlit Garden at large?
I think so. The Sunlit Garden, I'm ready to close the book on her for now.
Yes, but what a fun book. And yeah, so I guess to wrap up the episode, I do want to say, we kind of had talked about it now, but ever since we started, the Utena fan community has been out in droves. Thank you all so much for listening. So many amazing resources and just, like, love has been, like, sent our way instantly, the instant this came out. So I just want to say thank you to everyone listening who's, like, part of that community. Or if you're not, to know that there is a huge, awesome Utena family out there that you can join, that we've been fully welcomed into.
Yeah, while we were recording, we hit 100 followers on Twitter. Thank you it's just been incredible. I this has been the first time I've gotten, like, into, like, a quote-unquote, like, new fandom and in a long time, and it's seriously, like, everyone has been so nice and it's so helpful with so much knowledge. Thank you. And we're so excited to keep going. Speaking of that, Derek, I'm, like, springing this on you now, but I think we should, like, before, when this episode drops, we should get it set up where we can have our, like, where people can send in questions or comments.
Yes.
For our we will be doing, like, kind of a mailbag episode at the end of the first arc of the show, kind of a recap. And so we'll try whatever form that's going to take. We'll try to have that set up for when this episode comes out, I think would be good. Cause
yes.
I had a few people DM me personally and I'm like, oh, I want to, like, collect these things.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, we'll do a mailbag episode at the end of each arc. And we'll tell people when the end of the arc is, when we get there. But I also want to say before we go that Christine and I, We guested on Imagine Me and Yuri Kuma, which is another, they recapped Utena before, but now they're recapping another Ikuhara work, Yuri Kuma Arashi. And so we guested on there and talked about Utena for a bit. But fair warning, if you are watching this show for the first time, we do get into some spoiler territory. So if you're not looking to get spoiled, don't listen to that. Maybe save it for later. But it was a fun conversation with some cool people. And go check them out.
We will definitely link that when it's out, and we'll put in the tweet just a reminder that it's has spoilers in it. And who knows, maybe we'll see some of them on our show
at some
point. We're hoping to have guests eventually. So we'll see. Derek and I needed to get our like podcasting deer legs, baby deer legs, going for this show. But I think we're hitting our stride, so it'll be fun to have some friends on occasionally.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Christine, do you want to remind the people where to find you?
Yeah. So you can follow me on Twitter at @xteen_files and on Instagram at @thexteenfiles. And if you like a reality television program Survivor, you can read my writing on Inside Survivor.
Nice. You can find me at Rain Dirks on Twitter. And you can find me on my other podcast, Bitter Jurors, at Bitter Jurors Pod on Twitter and Instagram, where currently we're talking about Legend of Korra, but we will also be talking about Survivor here sooner than you might think. Look forward to that. Thank you all for listening so much, and thank you, Christine, once again for going on this journey with me.
Yes, and next episode we will be talking about just one episode. We'll be talking about so this is episode six. Yes, Take Care, Miss Nanami. So based on the title, you can maybe assume this is gonna be a funny one.
Hell yes. All righty, thank you all for listening, and see you next week.
See ya.
Bye.